This episode is an exclusive insight into the views of the LGIM investment team on what's happening in markets and what this means for investors. This podcast is intended for investment professionals. If you're enjoying LGIM Talks, why not subscribe in your Apple Podcast or Spotify app to make sure you never miss an episode.
Hello and welcome to this CIO market update from LGIM. I'm Max Julius, Head of Content, and I'm delighted to be joined by Sonia Loud, CIO, John Rowe, Head of Multi-Asset Funds, and Nick Stansbury, Head of Commodity Research, for a special energy-focused session. A quick housekeeping note for our podcast listeners. You can find the slides that we referred to on a link to the webinar in this episode's show notes. Now, with no further ado, I'll hand over to Sonia to walk us through the latest virus developments, the health of the global economy, and the state of financial markets.
Great. Thank you very much, Max, and a very warm welcome from my side as well. As usual, I hope you are joining us healthy and safe. So quick update on virus and the economy, because obviously there has been a huge shift towards political news. We've had the first presidential debate, and yesterday we had the first debate of Kamala Harris and Mike Pence. So lots going on in terms of the run-up to the US election, and this is why this week we have added actually a few slides to share some thoughts on how we see this working towards the election night. Now, in terms of the virus update, you will have seen all the headlines. It's very clear that Europe in particular is still seeing quite a dramatic increase in new cases. So far, governments have been able to address these more with local measures rather than a full-blown lockdown, but we have to be very much prepared that moving into autumn, we have to assume that cases will rise further, and as such, we still cannot rule out to see further restrictive measures being imposed. Now, in terms of the economic developments, it's very clear that the immediate V-shaped recovery now has moved towards a much flatter and more stable economic backdrop. There has been, obviously, a bit of a setback of late when the U.S. couldn't agree yet to launch another stimulus package. And as you can see here very clearly, we are expecting a much slower economic backdrop going forward. And it's even clearer now that without a vaccine, we will not see full normalization happening. And as such, you will see in a second as well that markets have reacted accordingly, so a much clearer picture in the context of how the economy has settled post the immediate recovery when lockdown measures were lifted. If you look at the slide in front of you now, this is something that we have repeated a number of times, but I think it's been very much supported by recent news flow. And I think in particular, the vaccine development news currently are more interpreted negatively because it's been a while that we had a real breakthrough on how we can expect a vaccine to be distributed widely. And as I just said, it is absolutely vital that a vaccine will be developed because otherwise it will be very difficult to see a full normalization in the economic context. Policy support is the other area where we had a recent setback and clearly has led us to downgrade our forecast, particularly for the fourth quarter, because the impasse in the US in moving forward another package clearly will weigh on consumer sentiment and spending, because it's particularly the short-term liquidity measures that, if not renewed, will clearly have an impact on consumer spending. Economic scarring, again, has been in the news, and we have debated this number of times here on the call. But obviously, this is very much linked to what I've just said, because it's very clear that we probably do not have the full picture yet in terms of the longer-term unemployment implications of COVID-19 and the so-called reallocation effect. But it's becoming clearer that obviously the longer it takes to produce a vaccine, the longer the most impacted sectors will struggle, and as such, the bigger the reallocation effect might be. Now, looking at markets, it's very clear that this has had an impact on overall market developments, and you see very clearly here that Q3 has been very much subdued compared to, obviously, Q1 and Q2, very much linked to the economic development that I've just shown you. But you can see that markets are in a waiting pattern as well, simply because there's quite a few political events on the agenda for the fourth quarter. The presidential election, the most important one, but clearly Brexit talks here in Europe will weigh on sentiment as well. Now, I would like to spend a few minutes on the US election, because it's clearly been a very tumultuous period, not least because the US President, Mr. Trump, has had to report his own COVID infection, and that in itself obviously has led to a number of question marks and quite a lot of volatility. Now, as you can see, the market clearly believes that the US election is a market-moving event, and we would agree with it. And as such, we have to assume that whatever the outcome will look like, there is clear implications for a number of asset classes. So let's have a look at the predictions around Trump's re-election for the time being. And I think ever since not only the referendum vote here in the UK, but also the last US election, we are all a bit more careful when it comes to trying to predict these outcomes and voting behavior. But you can see very clearly that in terms of the Trump job approval ratings, this is the lighter green line, there has been clearly a dip towards June, July on the back of the COVID-19 handling, which has now slightly recovered and probably will remain there or thereabout. But you can see far more volatile are the betting odds on Trump's re-election chances. So we will see how this is going to work out over the last 4 weeks. Battleground states, again, have been very much under watch because they have played such a decisive role in the last US election. And it's very clear that Florida, interestingly, has seen quite a big drop for Trump support. And actually, I've seen interviews over the past couple of days with residents in Florida saying they just disapprove Trump's handling of COVID-19. Given that the average age, I think, is around 65 in Florida, it's very clear that they obviously feel that they're scared and feel at risk from the handling of the pandemic. Likewise, Pennsylvania, interestingly, and this is the flip side, right? In Pennsylvania, you see actually more the approval for Biden jumping rather than in Florida, Trump's approval dropping. So quite interestingly, and it's obviously a very different motivation, but there will be a lot more focus on those swing states over the next couple of weeks to see how this will work out. Now, as I've touched upon, depending on the outcome, there's obviously this different read across for markets and asset classes. And we have tried to summarize these in a kind of matrix structure here. I would like to point out particularly the blue sweep at the bottom and the negative impact on equities and treasuries. And I think here we have to consider higher taxes. And I think the second point is, the impasse right now around the second stimulus package is literally the size where the Democrats are aiming for a $2.5 trillion package versus, I think, sitting around $800 billion. So big changes in the way fiscal deficits and fiscal spending will be looked at, and hence obviously very different implications for markets. You see, likewise, the red sweep would be far more positive for equities, pretty much following on what Trump has implemented during the first 4 years. This is why it is so important. This is why markets are waiting for the election to tell us where we are heading. But it's very clear as well that we have to accept that there might be a risk that on election night there will not be a clear result, and as such we will have to wait for a while until we get clarity around who is the next president of the United States. As we know, Trump has very much played his China policy for a while, and we have been sharing the slide before because it's very clear that this actually has been a big supportive element for Trump's ratings, because most Americans actually are not seeing China as favorable and hence have been very supportive of Trump's very hard stance towards China. Now, as Mark said in his introduction, today we really would like to focus on the energy complex. And as you know, we at LGIM have a macro thematic process that is looking at long-term structural themes. And it's very clear that throughout the pandemic, we have seen a number of these long-term structural themes accelerating. And climate change, and hence the implication for the energy complex, is very clearly accelerating further. And there's a much broader support through policymakers and central banks to move this forward and use this crisis and the pandemic to make the recovery a green recovery. Now, as we know, it's not just obviously policymakers that will determine the oil price or will have an influence on this segment. Geopolitics have always been a big driver of the oil price. And this is why at this stage I would like to ask John the first question in terms of how we assess the implication of the current geopolitical situation on the oil price, and whether a Biden administration could actually change this. And lastly, bringing in obviously the Iran nuclear deal, and again, whether a change in the administration would have implications on that. John, over to you.
Thank you very much, Sonia. So I wanted to start by talking about just the sheer scale of the impact that the coronavirus has had on oil demand, on energy demand, because it's been of a completely different level to anything that you would see in a normal recession. And of course, that has had very large implications for the size of the reaction that OPEC Plus, so OPEC Plus Russia and others, have had to undertake to try and control the price and evolve a glut, leading to a very, very low price and problems for them fiscally. So this is one of my favorite pandemic slides. I'm not sure you're allowed favorite slides to do with a global pandemic, but if you are, this is my favorite. And it is all about the amount of activity that we see in large economies. And what we have here is you can see that post-lockdown, these different regions and countries have really struggled to get back to 100%, a very dark blue we're looking for on this stringency index. And off the back of that, it's a reminder of how much activity is still being suppressed. So I'll come on to the political side and China, but starting with the broader picture, we saw a total fall in oil demand back in April of around 22 million barrels, which is nearly 25% of global oil demand. And as we're here today, we're still around 10% down on where it was pre-virus, and that's expected to run through all the way through to when a vaccine is found. So a gradual improvement, but only very gradual. And we've seen in Europe how hard it is to open up activity without having a resurgence in the virus. So off the back of that, we've seen this very impressive actually fall in geopolitical tension within OPEC and OPEC Plus, where they've got together and they've effectively said, we have to find a solution to this, because if you're going to control a price, as OPEC is aiming to do, then you need to work to avoid a glut, because unfortunately, if there's a glut of supply, you can't control the price. And all of your efforts to maintain the price at a level that you feel is appropriate for the long term and encourages investment in oil exploration, all of that falls apart if you have a supply glut. So we saw this massive reaction in the energy space, around 15 million barrels a day reduction from OPEC and friends. And this is really testing the kind of the geopolitical kind of dimensions in that region, because a lot of these countries aren't natural allies and yet are forced to work together through COVID and in some way put their differences to one side until they come out the other side. But then you come on to China, and coming back to the more geopolitical side, you can see actually China has done better than most countries on this stringency index. So you can see that darker blue for China towards the right-hand side than for most other countries. And this is something that we think could actually stoke geopolitical tension in the future. And we've seen this from the Trump administration in the last 24 hours, with him tweeting the fact that the impact of the virus is not Americans' fault, and he will make China pay for it. It's a very subjective perspective, of course, but it is one that we may hear a lot more of, particularly if there's a perception that through being aware of the virus earlier, China was in some way able to deal with its impact better, and that benefited it on a relative basis compared with other countries. So when we look at that, we then look at that, how long will this go on, and when might we see this ramp up in tension? Well, in reality, most countries can't afford a kind of exogenous shock right now. So if you would be very brave to start some sort of tariff war in the midst of a global pandemic, because you've already got businesses suffering, and inevitably tariffs are ultimately paid by US consumers. US tariffs are paid by US consumers and by US companies. And so from that perspective, you'd be very brave to take that kind of action. So more likely feels that that will be ramped up as economies recover. And that all comes down to when we see the vaccine, which will be a savior for the oil industry, because it will allow activity to go back to normal. People can go back to transporting goods. They can go back to using cruise liners and all these other great activities. But it could also be this catalyst for friction, because it's coming out the other side of this tumultuous period where the globe has had to kind of pull together to fight the vaccine, that we might see more pointing of fingers and more efforts to stoke up domestic kind of issues, like it's China's fault, which is one perspective that's been highlighted by Trump. And against that backdrop, even in the under a Biden administration, any future action against China, in our opinion, is more likely at the back end of the COVID-19 pandemic rather than in the midst of it, because you just can't afford a further battering to your economy. So the underlying problem that we have between China and the US, and the reason that actually, regardless of who wins the election, the policy on the geopolitical side to China won't change much, is this Thucydides trap. And this was this idea that when you have an existing power and you have a new power, then you have this natural tension between them, which can often lead to outright war and conflict. And even if it doesn't, it leads to a lot of tension and can be quite damaging for the existing global superpower, or the one that is a threat to it. In this instance, of course, we have China as the up-and-coming superpower, and we have US as very clearly the dominant one. And that tension will remain, because there will be a worry about what it means if this other country starts to threaten dominance, and that will lead to tension economically in areas around military as well, and in around influence, which is what we saw, of course, during the Cold War, with all sorts of things going through. And then finally, I would touch on would just be on back to the oil side. So we've talked a bit about both. OPEC has done a fantastic job. This graph is showing excess inventories effectively. And you can see towards the right-hand side, there was a very sharp pickup. But then more recently, they managed to drive that back down to more normal levels. And that's them driving down this overhang, this glut of production that came from April. So as long as there isn't a structural fall in oil demand upcoming, then this will start to get to a better situation for OPEC, where they can start to increase production. The last thing I would say is if Biden wins the White House, he has made it very clear that his policies will be more climate friendly. And a natural implication of that will be a drive within the US in particular, but potentially leading something more broadly to actually cut oil demand, reduce carbon emissions. And a Biden win would definitely introduce a structural headwind for energy demand, and also for US in particular energy suppliers, given the types of climate restrictions there might be around emissions for producers as well.
So John, on the back of all of this, how can you position in oil and commodity markets? Where do you see the opportunities, and where's the biggest risks?
So what's been really, really interesting, so generally we see ourselves as contrarian investors. So within the asset allocation team and LG more generally, we're generally like something more if everybody hates it. And going into 2020, it's fair to say that energy was already pretty much a hated sector. And that was for a combination of reasons, some of which was concerns around US shale and a lack of pricing power. Some of it was around the growing focus on the environment and on climate change and on the implications that might have. And partly that was on a realization that peak oil might happen earlier than expected. What was really interesting then was in 2020, it's been the worst performing sector by an extreme margin. So year to date, returns on US energy are something like minus 50%, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. When you think about the US is on the other side of that equation and is at more like plus 25%, which is what I show on this Next slide. So actually from here, the energy sector does look remarkably beaten up, having lost a vast amount of its value, particularly in US energy, but also within European energy. And I think most importantly for us, that highlights the importance of diversification. So even if you own a lot of US, you'd have owned more US energy than if you owned a more globally diversified portfolio. For example, European energy has not done as badly as US energy. Equally, the sector divergence here has been huge, so kind of 75% difference in returns between different sectors. Now, it is possible, though difficult, to take views on which sectors will do best. And so, for example, we were overweight information technology going into 2020 and have remained that way throughout because we believe there's a structural underlying trend which is still not fully priced by markets. But equally, it shows how extreme the outcomes can be and the importance of that structural diversification. We think being positive energy is pretty difficult. Our natural inclination would be to be positive simply because it's so detested as a sector. But we believe there's this structural headwind coming from ESG-related flows and from more and more clients looking to reduce weights to the energy sector. That means that dislike and those structural underweights could remain in place for a very long time. So on that basis, you have natural exposure to the equities you own in the portfolio. Oil itself is something where we take very limited risk currently. Outside of that, within commodities, we do have exposure to things like gold on the other side of the spectrum, which is not part of the energy complex and has much more defensive characteristics, of course.
John, thank you very much for talking through those dynamics. Let's bring Nick in at this point. Nick, actually, on something that John just talked about, how do you think Biden's climate plan could make a difference in the event, of course, that he wins the election, to the trajectory of global warming?
Hi, Max. So, the starting point is to think about where the US currently is in terms of its stance and its pathway on climate-related matters. And we should be really, really clear that the US is one of, if not the world's laggards in terms of its positioning as regards climate and carbon. Our analysis suggested that the US broadly aligned to something like 3 to 3.5 degrees of global warming by the turn of the century, very little outside of some specific state policies, very little in terms of progressive forward-looking climate policies. So in terms of the size of the potential move, given the extent to which they are an underperformer, there's a long way that they could come. And the implications of that are likely to be felt, I think, in two dimensions. The first is the sort of the macro policies that they put in place, that they would be able to be put in place. And the second is the implication on the energy sector itself. That is probably more significant in the short term because of how significant some of those regulatory developments might turn out to be. We might see significant tightening, for example, on environmental regulation. The US, one of the worst performers globally when it comes to flaring and methane leakage. Methane, we know, is an extremely potent warming gas, and the US performs very badly, we think, when it comes to looking at the amount of methane that is leaked or flared in the production of oil and gas out of U.S., particularly shale wells. That's really significant. So, for example, in Houston, flaring had become, during the height of Permian mania, flaring had become such a significant issue that actually the Houston Observatory wasn't able to function properly because the night sky was so badly illuminated by the flaring from the wells that were being drilled where the natural gas in the Permian was simply being burnt off as a waste product because nobody was able to put in place the necessary capturing and gathering infrastructure to gather it up. Those sorts of policies, progressive policies towards tightening environmental restrictions, would, in our view, significantly increase the cost burden on much of US oil and gas production. They'd be very progressive, but have significant implications for the sector. But also, a series of progressive climate policies would be really important as well. And that's going to have effects beyond the borders of the United States. So one of the biggest challenges with dealing with global warming is the free rider problem, the fact that It makes very little sense for one economic region of the world to take deeply progressive climate policies if every other region is not going to do so and simply freeload on their efforts. And this is a challenge which we need everybody to take a coordinated approach on. And therefore, that the US was so clearly lagging in terms of progressive policies has been a significant headwind to other parts of the world taking the policy measures that they needed to take in order to put the world onto a sustainable footing. So we are enthused about the possibility of a significant change in the US's attitudes and policies as regards climate. I think it's a significant area where we might see some forward progress, and the election is undoubtedly going to be a crucial turning point in that.
Well, thanks for that, Nick. Very striking example there as well you cited. I'm conscious of the time, so I'll just ask a quick fire question now, which is a broader point, and that is, are climate related risks being accurately priced into the market? And if not, and this touches on a question from one of our clients, when do you think they will be?
This is a tremendously difficult question to address. It's one to which we've given a lot of thought, devoted a lot of analytical resource. Our view remains that they are not, in general, properly priced. And we try and look at this in two ways. We look at this top-down, and we look at this bottom-up. So from the bottom-up, it becomes the most stark, I think. So when we look and compare company against company, where we know from our own research that these two companies, due to sort of fundamental things about the structure of their businesses, we tend to see very little differentiation in the way the market prices those risk and evolutions of how that climate risk might evolve. For example, two industrial companies in Europe, one of which has large hedged exposure to rising carbon prices and the other doesn't, we don't seem to have a difference in the way that the market prices that risk when we look at the two companies. The second way to try and look at the risk is to think about it from the top down and to try and look through some sort of robust and rigorous modeling process. No surprise, sort of thing. We've also done a lot of work on to try and understand what the scale of the climate risk is for different sectors. And when we do that work, we can see that there are really significant risks out there for a number of sectors. The carbon intensive, capital intensive, industrial parts of the global economy, very, very sensitive to a rise in carbon prices. And that doesn't seem to be priced. That said, when we look at the energy sector and the scale of the underperformance that John's outlined, we're starting to wonder whether actually a reasonable amount of climate risk is now getting priced into that sector. It's gone from being, in the case of the S&P 500, mid-teens as a weight in that benchmark to about 2% today. Really startling underperformance over the period of about a decade. And of that, we can attribute lots of that to factors, some of that to the very, very bad allocation of capital that the sector has been a terrible allocator of capital for a long time, destroyed a lot of lot of shareholder value. A lot of that is self-inflicted upon themselves. But some of it appears in our minds to be being attributed rightly to the prospect of rising risks and volatility in the sector as peak oil demand emerges, and then continuing concerns around the sector's underperformance on many ESG credentials. So we don't think, in general, on balance, risks properly reflected today. When are they likely to be priced in? Well, I don't know, but if they're going to get priced in, it will be over about the next decade. So yes, long term, yes, long way away, but absolutely within the time horizons of long-term investors like us. Over the next 7 years, why? Because the world's got about 7 or 8 years left to determine the climate outcome that we get. So we think next 7 to 8 years, absolutely crucial. That's the time horizon over which the world needs to make the relevant policy decisions.
Brilliant. Thank you. And just before we finish up today, in fact, I think I'll just hand over to Sonia and say we've dealt on some very important environmental questions. Looking briefly at the S in ESG, do you think the pandemic has changed the way investors look at social factors? And is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish up?
Yes, thank you, Max. And I think that brings me very neatly back to this concept of accelerating change, because we have now spoken in detail around the E, and it's very clear that through the pandemic, we have seen a huge acceleration in terms of global attention to climate change and how we can use the crisis in moving this forward. And I think both our speakers have very clearly highlighted how markets have looked at this and most likely will look at this in the future. Now, another topic that really has accelerated through the pandemic is what you've just rightly referred to as the S in ESG, i.e. the social impact. And it's very clear that the pandemic has had an above average impact on lower income households and ethnic minorities. And this will not go unnoticed. Again, inequality is not a new topic. It's been very much on the agenda prior to the pandemic, but has seen a huge acceleration throughout the pandemic. And it's very clear that we are getting increasingly requests on how this will be reflected. And I'm very pleased to say that we have announced just recently that going forward, LGIM will potentially vote against boards that are not addressing ethnic underrepresentation on their boards. So very much in line with the push we had towards gender equality, we will now pick up the ethnic representation because we believe that this is absolutely crucial and we would like to make sure that this is understood. This is interestingly more a topic for Europe than the US, but nevertheless, it's very clear that investors are very keenly aware that this has to be addressed as well as the E and obviously the G.
That's a great point on which to finish this week's call. I'd like to thank you, Sonia, John and Nick, for your time today. I'd like to thank our clients for logging in. Our next call is on the 4th of November when Sonia will be joined by Jason Shoup and Tim Drayson to dissect the aftermath of the US election results.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.